Good evening, everyone, and welcome. My name is Tom Carroll, and I'm a member of the Future Church Board, as well as the chair of the Program Committee of Future Church. And we certainly are delighted to see so many of you this evening, as we do celebrate the Feast of Mary of Magdala and the women who are part of the ministry of Paul. This evening, are any of you new to Future Church? I'm sorry, are any of you new to Future Church? You maybe haven't been here before, you've heard a little and so forth. Future Church certainly is a great organization seeking full participation across the board in every aspect of the church. How important that is, and how important that has been for us for so many years. You really are part of a very important event tonight. The Mary of Magdala projects were started, begun, and are now part of an actual international movement attempting to correct the mistaken notion that Mary of Magdala was a prostitute. And thus, she has been raised to her true identity as the first witness of the resurrection. Annually, Future Church organizes special celebrations of this July 22nd feast. This year, there are approximately 250 celebrations throughout the United States and throughout the world. We are aware of at least 5 in Australia, several in England, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands. There's also one in Uganda at which they expect some 1,000 people. What a way to celebrate. What a way to recognize the people, the ministry of the church. We do celebrate Mary of Magdala, her discipleship, her role as the apostle to the apostles. And it helps to make Mary of Magdala a true disciple of Jesus, and the primary witness to the resurrection, so much more widely known to Catholics and all sorts of people everywhere. This year, Future Church asked the celebration organizers to recognize the women who ministered with St. Paul, such as Phoebe, Junia, Lydia, Prisca. And we feel that raising the awareness of these early leaders of the church is a fitting end to the church's year of St. Paul. At this time, I'd like to ask Janet Kodrich, who is the Director of Public Relations for Light of Hearts Villa, to say a few words.
Good evening. Usually I don't need a microphone, but so everyone can hear me. I'd like to welcome everyone here to Light of Hearts Villa. Thank you, Tom. I am the Public Relations and Marketing Director here. When Sister Helen walked in, I told her I was going to go home, and she said, oh, no, you're not. She hired me 7 years ago, almost 7 years, and thank you, Sister Helen. I've had a wonderful, wonderful time in watching the growth here at Light of Hearts Villa and celebrating our mission. We are an assisted living independent, and we have a dementia wing, and we were retrofitted by Sister Helen Therese Gasney and Sister Regina Kushner, and they made this all happen. We are sitting here in the middle of the gymnasium, so it got a different look as a teacher a number of years ago, didn't it, Sister Helen? The faces have changed. Sister Marian Flannery also is part of Light of Hearts Villa and former teacher, and we've seen the faces change. The elderly people that do live here are very special. We practice person-centered care, and we focus on the positive affirmation of everyone making their own choices. If after the meeting you'd like to take a drop down the hall, we have a beautiful chapel that still has a stained glass window and has been retrofitted for our community population here. But welcome, enjoy your meeting, and I am so happy to host it here for you. Again, thank you.
Thank you, Jenna. Just a couple of things to kind of let you know what's going on this evening. We will begin with prayer, and then ask Dr. McGinn to speak. We will ask for a free will offering, and there will be an update on some of Future Church's programs, some time for questions and answers, a brief closing prayer, and then some refreshments. I would ask at this time that anyone who may have a cell phone to please make sure it's in the off position or the vibrating position. I'd also like to let you know that the men's and women's restrooms are right outside this door to the right. Okay? If you happen to get lost, I understand that Roberta out here will be very helpful to all of us. I draw your attention this evening to our Future Church information tables in the back. Hopefully you signed up when you came in, you got a name tag, and you're now eligible to win our door prize. I have no idea what it is. The information table has many resources. Some are free, and some are available at a nominal cost. There are additional postcards like the ones in your program, and our staff and volunteers are here to help you and answer questions. We are trying some new technology this evening. I'm not the one trying it. In order to record Dr. McGinn, if successful, her presentation this evening will be posted on the Future Church website or available at cost on CD. If you are interested in purchasing a CD, please leave your name and email address at the Future Church information table this evening. At this time, I am very pleased to introduce and welcome Ann Klonowski, who will lead us in prayer.
Let us recall that we are in the presence of our good and gracious God. Weaver God, at the beginning of time, you began a great tapestry of life, woven in all the colors of the rainbow.
We, your daughters and sons, bear the river of all that we have.
Jesus wove together a community of women and men and commanded them to go and tell all nations of your glory and saving grace. We celebrate tonight all those who have proclaimed that good news, especially the women leaders in the early church.
May your spirits and dedication of these women inspire us to say, go and tell everything you say.
All praise to you, O God, who holds together the tapestry of history, weaving life and love into every age.
Amen. Reading from the Gospel of John. But Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not recognize that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means beloved teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary of Magdala went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord." And she told him that he had said these things to her. Mary of Magdala, woman whom Jesus loved much, woman entrusted with the gospel, you were chosen as first to witness and to announce the resurrection. Guide us in our pursuit of truth, service, and equality in Christ, the risen one.
A reading from Romans. I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church of Chantre, so that you may welcome her in the Lord as is fitting for the saints, and help her in whatever she may require from you, for she has been a benefactor of many and of myself as well. Greet Prisca and Aquila, who work with me in Christ Jesus, and who risk their necks for my life, to whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. Greet also the church in their house. Greet my beloved Epaphroditus, who was the first convert in Asia for Christ. Greet Mary, who has worked very hard among you. Greet Andronicus and Junia, my relatives who were born in prison, who were imprisoned with me. They are prominent among the apostles, and they were in Christ before I was. Greet Ampelitus, my beloved in the Lord. Greet Urbanus, our co-worker in Christ, and my beloved Stachys. Greet Apelles, who is approved in Christ. Greet those who belong to the family of Aristobulus. Greet my relative Herodian. Greet those in the Lord who belong to the family of Narcissus. Greet those workers in the Lord. Tryphene and Tryphosa. Greet the beloved Persis, who has worked hard in the Lord. Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and greet his mother, a mother to me also, who are with them. Greet Asyncritus, Legion, Hermes, Patrobus, Hermas, and the brothers and sisters who are with them. Greet Philologus, Julia, Nereus, and his sister Olympus, and all the saints who are with them. Greet one another with a holy kiss. All the churches of Christ greet you. Phoebe, women deacon and envoy, who carried Paul's letter to the Romans. Junia, woman apostle, who with her husband Andronicus was imprisoned with Paul, and all the women named by Paul as disciples of Jesus, help our church today to grow in valuing the leadership of women.
Sheila E. McGinn, who earned her PhD at Northwestern University, which impresses the heck out of me because it's a way cool school, serves as professor of biblical studies and early Christianity at John Carroll University, which also impresses me because it's a very cool school. A scholar active on the international scene, Dr. McGinn has presented frequent academic papers on a range of topics relating to the New Testament and the early churches, as well as on the use of electronic media for biblical study, which is why there were at one point four computers up here, and now they're actually working. Her publications include books on Paul's letter to the Romans and the book of Revelation, essays on several of Paul's letters, studies of the passion resurrection stories in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, and commentaries on the Gospel of Matthew, the apocryphal Acts of Thecla, and the second century Montanist Oracles. La-di-da. She currently is developing a history of Christianity's first 100 years. In addition to all this official hoo-ha, Sheila is bright, witty, and articulate, and one of the best teachers I was ever privileged to learn from. She has forgotten more about the early church and the role of women in it than most folks will ever know, but tonight she's here to remedy that and to help us learn more about the mothers of the early church. It is my privilege and pleasure to present my friend and teacher, Sheila McGinn.
Thank you all. Thank you, Anne, Tom. Sneaking over here because I'm hoping this is the article that works the machines that we've got hooked up. Can y'all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Not very well. That had to happen. Just because I use technology doesn't mean it likes me. Is that better?
Yes.
But on the side over here, if you stand sort of not quite on your head, but sideways, it says the 13th annual St. Mary of Magdala celebration for Future Church. So, anyway, I figured you already knew that part. That's why I stuck it in sideways. It was the only way to get it in there. But, yay, it worked. Okay, cool. We are going now. Okay, now, Paul didn't know Mary of Magdalene, as far as I know. But given that this is her feast and not his, I figured it was only fair to do something about St. Mary Magdalene. And one of the cool things was that I found these two icons of her. The one on the right is a relatively recent one. That you can find in a book by Joan Chittister called The Friendship of Women. And the artist who did the icons is named Marcy Bercher, published in 2000, so quite recent. That's why the inscription on the one on the right is actually in English, whereas the one on the left, being an ancient icon, is in Greek. One of the cool things, however, about the ancient icon is the title that it gives Mary Magdalene. So it's not just St. Mary of Magdala, which, you know, would be kind of the normal thing that you'd see in an icon. This one says St. Mary Magdalene, Myrrh Bearer. That's why she's got the little jar with the oil in it, right? Remember the scene at the tomb, she's going to anoint Jesus, the one from John 20 that we heard the first reading. Myrrh bearer and equal of the apostles. This is a traditional Orthodox icon. And you can find it yourself if you want. You'll go on the Antiochene Orthodox Church website where they have a whole slew of icons of various and sundry types. But this is a fascinating thing to me. Why is it that in the Middle Ages, it's probably 12th century, something like that, I'm just guessing, but a lot of those types were sort of set at about that time. Why can they remember that she's equal to the apostles? In the Western Church, we called her Apostola Apostolorum, apostle to the apostles, which actually is a superlative form in the Latin, as in first among the apostles. Okay. Why is it that during the Middle Ages we could remember this of women leaders in the early church, but after the Enlightenment somehow we all got communal Alzheimer's, you know, selective Alzheimer's, you know, ecclesiastical Alzheimer's is different than Irish Alzheimer's where all you remember are the grudges. Ecclesiastical Alzheimer's is the kind of thing where all you remember are the men, which is kind of fascinating. And I figure I'm outed now. So, hey, I can say anything after this. I'm already in trouble, right? Anyway, So that's all I have to say about Mary Magdalene. And if you have questions, we can talk about her later. But I'm supposed to be talking about the women who worked with Paul, so we're going to nod our heads and say thank you very much, Mary, and move along here. Oops, don't do that. Paul's missionary journeys, which is like minuscule print, so I'm sure you can't see anything. I just realized that Americans aren't so good on geography. I know the Middle East really well. I can't do the United States. Anything east of the Mississippi, or in particular anything east of Pennsylvania, forget it. All those little states up there in the Northeast, you know. Yeah, exactly. I mean, come on, they're smaller than my hometown. Who cares? But anyway, just to remind you, you know, the place with, that looks like a booth, that's Italy. The area we'll be talking about is this region right in here. Okay. Basically that sort of semicircle around the Aegean. Okay? And also, just to give you a little sense of, if you were there, what it sort of looks like today. I have no clue what it looked like 2,000 years ago. But this is one of the harbors at one of the Greek islands. And here's a ship that's roughly about the size of one that Paul would sail in. Today, this is probably privately owned. It's about 125 feet long or thereabouts. Can you imagine sailing Mediterranean in a ship that size? But 150 feet was a very common size sailing vessel. So if you remember the book of Acts and the fact that just about every other page or so Paul's talking about being shipwrecked, and you look at this size ship compared to, say, you know, Carnival Cruise Lines or something like that, you get a little sense of why that might actually have been the case. Okay, and this is Romans 16. It's really tiny print too, but it's because I just wanted to give you sort of a visual look of all those names that were rattled off when Bill did the reading. I've highlighted in red any of the sections of Romans 16 that has to do with the women who were mentioned. Not that the men weren't important. I'm just trying to show you proportionally, you know, in a visual way. At least in terms of the English, how much press do the women get in this particular chapter compared to how much press do the men get? And you'll notice that actually, for this particular list of names, actually the women, I think, you know, had the edge a little bit. Now, if we did it in the original language, it might come out more evenly. But at any rate, there are a lot of women in here, and Paul's saying a lot of things about those various and sundry women. What I'm going to do for the first part of this talk is to go through the list in the order in which the women are presented here. Then I'm going to bring in a couple other women who are mentioned in Acts as being part of the Pauline mission field, even though they're not mentioned, they don't live in Rome, so they're not mentioned in this letter addressed to Rome. So the first one on the list is Phoebe. So here's Phoebe, right? The one on the left is a stained glass window from an Australian church where Phoebe's depicted as a young woman, and the scroll in her hand, the linen scroll that she's holding, is supposed to be actually Romans, and it shows 16:1, not the content of the verse, but it shows the reference to that verse, so that you'll know that that's who it is in the picture. The one on the right is this more contemporary icon that was done by the woman I mentioned earlier. Okay, so Paul gives Phoebe two titles and then attributes two traits to her that are sort of quasi-titular traits. First title he gives her is Diakonos, and in some English translations it'll say minister, and in some it will say deacon. And in some, it will say deaconess. And the reason why I put the Greek up here is because there's no way it's deaconess. He actually uses the masculine form of the noun, which is very odd. You know, English, it's all one, more or less, anymore. You still distinguish maybe between an actor and an actress, but a lot of times even women who are in the acting field are called actors, right? But in Greek, it's very definite. You've got gendered nouns, and so if it's a woman who's an actor, you know, she'd be an actress. If it's a woman who's a deacon, she'd be a deaconess. But actually, she's not a deaconess. She's a diakonos instead of diakona. So that's interesting, and it's not because somebody screwed up copying. There's no textual variant on this verse. So it strikes me as something that probably Paul was trying to make a point. And it's curious to me, to put in the right column there. I suppose I should have turned it around and put it in the left, but whatever. In looking over people talking about this verse, about half of the time, somebody says, well, we're not really sure she was a deacon. We're not really sure it counted as a title. We're not really sure it was a church office. And I think that's really curious, because if it was Timothy, deacon of the church of Kenchrea, I don't think anybody would make that comment. And so it just strikes me as odd about why, when it's there in print, we have to argue about whether it's there in print. We have to argue about whether it actually means for her what it would mean undisputably for any man. And this kind of circular reasoning, if you've done any study of early church history, it is one of the things that you see all the time, right? Well, women weren't active in those roles. How do you know? Well, because these texts that say women were active in those roles, those are only honorary titles. They didn't actually do them. So there were no women priests in Judaism, even though you got a list of about a dozen or so just from Alexandria alone. And not only from Alexandria, but from around Mediterranean world, there were no women priests in Christianity, because of course all of those were part of the heretical movement. Okay, anyway, so Levi is a deacon according to this list, right? There's only one other place in the undisputed letters of Paul where the word deacon shows up as a title for church offices, and that actually is in the city of Philippi, where they have multiple deacons and multiple overseers or bishops, and no presbyters are mentioned there. So we don't have a clue what a deacon did. If you look at the book of Acts, it's not cheating to try to figure out what Paul meant by deacon, since at least Acts talks about Paul, right? And the relationships with the various churches and such, if you can cheat that way and sort of infer backwards from looking at Acts, the deacons were the ones who were in charge of managing table fellowship. In other words, since there was no one who functioned like a priest in those days, the deacon was the one who was the closest to that particular role in the middle of the first century. So anyway, she's a minister of the church at Kenchrea, which is the port of Corinth. Everybody knows the important city of Greece. Paul tells the Roman church to give Phoebe an honorable welcome befitting her status. And this is part of one of the places where he hints around, he doesn't give her a title, but he hints around at her social status. And the language he uses conveys really clearly to the people in Rome that, look, I'm talking about a wealthy chick here. Don't screw up. Okay? You know, it sounds, when you're reading the modern translation, it sounds like, oh, you know, help her out however you can. What? She's going there for welfare? You know, she's bankrolled all these other ministers, and she's going there because she needs their help. No, he's saying, mind your P's and Q's. Don't screw up. He wants to go on to Spain. He wants to use Rome as the jumping-off point for a mission to the West, because he thinks he's done in the East. He thinks he's covered it all, right? And so who might help sponsor that mission? Well, if Phoebe's taking the letter, you know, she's going to be the person who's, for lack of a better word, schmoozing, you know, with the other folks in Rome who might be willing to help support that mission. So, you know, do whatever she asks is what he means, right? Don't mess up a good thing. The next title that he gives her is Prostatus, which sometimes is translated as benefactor, which is actually one of the better translations. Sometimes it's translated president, which is possible, although it has two democratic connotations to really make sense of the first century Roman world. But at any rate, it means that she's been a patron of the early Christian movement. And he says, she's been a patron of many, and of myself included. Okay. Now, this is an interesting piece because, and I know some of you have done a little reading on this area about patronage in the Roman world and how the whole patronage system works. Or, you know, I'm from Chicago. I think I knew this growing up without having read about Rome. You know, this is why they say it's the city that works, right? It's like what greases the skids. So you've got it. It's who you know, right, that determines how far you get. And it's who you know and who they know. You know, they make connections. Today we have a nicer word for it. We call it networking. It's the same thing. Okay? Except that networking doesn't necessarily require bribes as part of it. But anyway, she's been a patron. To be a patron meant not only do you have a piece of the action in terms of deciding how things are going to go, deciding what the plan is going to be in terms of the missionary agenda, you also have authority over the people whose patron you are. And if they say, look, Phoebe, I want to do this, and you say, no, I don't think that's a good idea. They say, you're right. I really think I ought to do this instead. Because if they don't, well, you know, you can take your little money and go home, right? You can find somebody else. Now, I'm not saying she worked that way and held it over people's head, but this is the way the system worked. So when you hear that Phoebe was Paul's patron, this is one of the discomforts with the title of this talk, which actually I'm to blame for, I think, at least in part, because I had done a little article on the same subject. They gave me the title for the article, right? Women Co-Workers of Paul. I'm going to put a spin on that, but I'm going to save that for the end so you don't fall asleep. Okay. Anyway, so Prostatus, patron, means she's got a lot of power. It might mean that she is the head person and that for the church in Kenchrea, and that the church actually meets in her home, in her villa. That's pretty likely. But that she has a certain amount of leverage with Paul in addition to just the church in Kenchrea. That's another piece that we tend to sort of overlook. Okay, Prisca is the next person mentioned. Prisca and her husband Aquila were co-workers in Christ Jesus. Sometimes that language of co-worker is, you know, sort of like, well, they're, you know, they're shelving the dry goods or whatever while he's out, you know, punching the Bible on the corner. Co-worker is a very laudable title in Paul's vocabulary. To be someone who bears the yoke, right, with another person. This is the image that's being conveyed here. It's like you have two oxen together, yoked together to pull a wagon or a plow or whatever it is. They are yoke fellows. Married couples are yoke fellows because they bear everything together. They get through life Right, it works, right? Yeah. They get through life because they're pulling together. And you have to be in sync with each other and that sort of thing. So it's a really cool image, a very common agricultural image. But it's also a very powerful image because if you remember Jesus' expression about come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will refresh you. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. So carrying on the gospel, carrying out the gospel, preaching the gospel, and carrying it to people who don't know about it is to bear the yoke of Christ. Okay, so this is the image he's trying to get at when he talks about these folks as co-workers, as yoke fellows with him in Christ. He also says they risk their necks to save his tail, which is really fascinating. Like, did they help him escape from prison at some point? He was in there a few times. There was definitely once or twice where he was pretty sure he wasn't going to come out, you know. So what on earth did they do? But that's kind of interesting. And that they risked their necks implies that they had a certain amount of leverage with the wider population. Prisca and Aquila have to be somewhat wealthy. I don't know how wealthy, but they have a home in Rome because of the Edict of Claudius in the late 40s. They have to leave Rome. They go to Corinth, which is where Paul meets them. I don't know about you, but I can afford two houses. Not even in one continent, no less across two continents, right? With a couple seas in between, right? So the idea of being able to just like pick up, go, and they don't rent or something. Like he works in their shop. They own the business, right? So they have to have a certain amount of money, but the money probably is hers, which is why her name is always mentioned first, because traditionally in Roman language, you introduce the husband and then the wife, not the other way around like we do in American custom, but she's always mentioned first. So at any rate, that's kind of interesting, and this is the tantalizing part about trying to study women in the early church. We know this much about them, you know, and just enough to get you interested, and then all the evidence poops out, right? And you have to sort of wing it as far as, okay, now where do you go from here? We have to hope for basically more excavations or something like that that will turn up more evidence, but just enough to tantalize you. I put this one in the middle, which is obviously a medieval painting, because I just love the fact that it illustrates St. Prisca as virgin and martyr. And the martyr part makes perfect sense. But it's kind of curious to talk about a married woman as the virgin, you know, or to give her that kind of a title. So I just thought that was really interesting. And you will note in the liturgical celebrations of women, including women doctors of the church, like Catherine of Siena, when you come to the prayers that you're supposed to do to honor that woman's feast day, it's the office of virgins that you do. It's not the office of doctors of the church that you do for the women. And so this is just kind of interesting. It's from a contemporary Italian website, right? And at any rate, so Prisca, who probably wasn't a virgin, but what the heck, you know? They had a house church. She and her husband had a house church in Rome by the time Paul's writing his last of his letters, which is in the late 50s, about 58 or thereabouts. Okay. Junia. Andronicus and Junia. Now here's more normal, right? These are very likely husband and wife, but he's mentioned first and then she. Only if she had higher social status, which he had been mentioned first, like was the case with Prisca. So greet Andronicus and Junia, who are Paul's kin of some sort. It says here relatives. I'm not sure I like that. Could just be that they were Jews. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean they're part of his immediate family, you know, somewhere within 6 degrees of separation, one assumes. But they shared time in prison with him, and they are prominent among the apostles. So you have Andronicus the left, and you have Junian on the right, and the dude in the middle who's got the bishop's studs on and stuff, because they were all martyred according to the tradition. Prominent among the apostles, I can't tell you how much argument has gone into this set of like three words to decide how to do away with the notion of Junian being an apostle, and especially being one who is noteworthy. And so the first thing that happened was an argument that, well, this is a typo or whatever the ancient equivalent would be. And it must really be a man's name. It must really be Junius. This text was 300 years later, that'd be a reasonable, conclusion. But the man's name, Junius, doesn't appear until the 4th century. And we're talking about a mid-1st century document, and, usually you don't argue backwards about historical trends, right? Usually. So, at any rate, this is one of the places where it seems so blunt. Paul calls himself an apostle. He thinks he knows what that means. He certainly knows that there are apostles in the church in Jerusalem, whom he actually doesn't talk about very politely, but, we won't go there. But he knows there are apostles, right? So why would he somehow not know what the word means when he uses it of these two people? That's just kind of interesting. And this is one of those superlative expressions, like I mentioned before. The of note among the apostles is like, not super apostle, but is one of the foremost apostles, or actually, in this case, a couple are. Interesting concept here, too, about married couples who minister together. Not something that you see much in the Catholic Church still today. You do see sometimes, you don't see it among clergy, but you do see it in other areas sometimes, but still not too common a thing. But it worked well in the ancient world, because I don't know about your family, but I know what happens to mine at Thanksgiving and stuff like that. The women are in the kitchen, the guys are sacked out on the couch watching the football game, right? I mean, you can't talk with both groups if you don't have somebody in each room. Right? In the ancient world, it was definitely divided like that. So. Okay, and now these are folks, these pictures, by the way, don't go with the names here. These people are so little known that we don't even really have icons of them. But you've got Mary, who has worked hard. That's another one of those sort of yoke fellow type of words. Timothy is described in the same way in one of Paul's other letters. Tryphena and Tryphosa are probably twin sisters, which is why they've got the cutesy names, that start the same and stuff like that. Okay, and they are also workers in the Lord, right? Worker's not a bad name. Worker's a somebody who slogs it out, okay? And it doesn't mean they're necessarily, like I said, stacking shelves. Rufus and his mother, and we have no clue what she did, or for that matter, we have no clue what Rufus did either. But all the people mentioned here at the end of Romans 16 are folks who had some sort of leadership position in one of the many house churches in Rome. We just don't have any definites about that. Julia, Nereus and his sister, and Olympus. Okay, again, folks we don't know anything about. But Julia, that's interesting because, of course, the Julia and Claudian house, the emperors of that era, could be either a rather aristocratic woman who's therefore named after the imperial house, or could be a slave woman who was liberated and then took the name of the patron in honor, and she wouldn't take Julius, she would take the feminine form. Some of the other names I'm not going to go into because they didn't have women in the list, But you do remember, you know, Narcissus and his household, Aristobulus and his household. The translation is a little awkward again on that point. It's not his family. These are the slaves who belong to the house of Narcissus, or the slaves who belong to the house of Aristobulus. So we're talking about a group of people which has to be, you know, both genders, has to be men and women in that group, but they're slaves who belong to this aristocratic household, one of which is linked to the imperial house, which is pretty interesting. And so already, you know, we're talking the mid-first century. Roman church has been around for about 20 years by now, and it's already moved up the echelons of society. Okay, Lydia, now we're skipping on to Acts, because like I said, these women aren't mentioned in Romans. This is Acts 16. It talks about just a little vignette, and this is part of the so-called we section of Acts. They come to Philippi, and remember, Philippi is the place that I said had deacons and bishops or overseers. Okay, so they come to Philippi, and on the Sabbath, instead of going to the synagogue, it's not a very Jewish town, so maybe there actually wasn't one, but instead of going there, they go down by the river, where there would be a lot of houses of worship, although typically various and sundry pagan temples. And so they're not actually inside a building there, they're just at the river. And it happens to be a whole group of women who are gathered at the river. Remember that old spiritual, right? So they go to the river, where they expect to find a group of people who are praying, and what they find as the group of people who are praying is a group of women who are praying. One of the ones there is named Lydia, and she gets pressed here because she's the most high class of all the folks who are there. She may or may not have been an aristocrat, but she's definitely a wealthy businesswoman. She's a dealer in purple dye, which is a very rare commodity. It's the kind of thing where actually there are laws about who can wear garments of purple and how much. And so only the emperor can wear a garment that's entirely purple. And if you're part of the senatorial class, you can wear a band of purple on your toga. But otherwise, pretty much, you're out of luck, hon. So, you know, think about who's she trading with. I mean, who are her clients, right? She's definitely at the upper crust of society here. And it says that she has a house, a household, okay? Not just a building, but an aristocratic size villa with people who belong to the household. Her actual house is across the way. Philippi is at the top of the Aegean. Thyatira is on the western coast of Asia, so just inland from Ephesus. And that's actually where her home is, in Thyatira, but she happens to be in Philippi doing the trading. It's a regional capital, so there would be folks of senatorial class who live there. Anyway, Lydia is already a God-fearer. That means she's already someone who is a Gentile who has converted to Judaism, although maybe hasn't gone through the ritual initiation process for that. And so she's already sort of primed for this whole message about Jesus and the one true God of Israel. And so she hears Paul's message and decides that this must be the right thing. She converts, and she and the members of her household were baptized. And she invited Paul and his companions to stay in her home. And it becomes the home base for mission in Philippi, which is interesting. She has her home, but they're in Philippi, which means she must have two of them, right? So definitely we're talking a wealthy woman here. Philippi is the one church that was the closest to Paul's heart. If you read the letter to the Philippians, he talks about it explicitly, actually, that you're the only group where I felt safe taking money from you, because I was worried other people would hold it over my head. And so economic support from them was something where he he didn't think he was going to be, they weren't going to put the screws to him for using, right? So it's kind of interesting, you know, and maybe you can reflect a little bit back from the letter to the Philippians as a whole and understand a little bit about the personality of somebody like Lydia. But like I said, this is a matter of extrapolation. It's not like we have evidence about this. So anyway, so she's the leader of a house church. In the letter to the Philippians, we hear of two women mentioned, Euodia and Syntyche. Say that 10 times really fast. And so we don't hear about Lydia in the letter. But, you know, she's traveling and that sort of thing. So they must be the local ministers for the church in Philippi. St. Thecla, she's not in the Bible at all, but I had to talk about her just because it's such a cool story. So I'll restrain myself, but I had to say a little bit. And the other thing about it is that here's an English one, here's a Greek one up in the corner, the Orthodox icon in the top right, the English version, the bottom left. They both say the same thing, the first martyr. But the Orthodox one is titled Thecla, St. Thecla, the proto-martyr, the first martyr, and equal to the apostles. Right? So Thecla and Magdalene both get this extra press about being equal to the apostles, which is something I just find really fascinating. And calling her proto-martyr, does anybody know why that might not really be accurate? Who's supposed to be the first martyr? Oh yeah, you all know that. Yeah, Stephen, right? Acts 7. He's getting stoned in the bad way, you know? Way before Thecla was probably even born. But somehow, he's not important enough to count. It's just fascinating why this young woman from Iconium, maybe it's a place thing, you know? Hometown girl made good, something like that. And Stephen, who's he, you know, he belongs in Alexandria, what do we care? I mean, you know, maybe that's all it is, because people were just as pumped about their, you know, hometown in the old days as we are today. Who knows? It's just fascinating. This is a little blip from an apocryphal writing called The Acts of Thecla. And this is basically the denouement of the story. Thecla has spent several years in ministry, evangelism, and that sort of thing. And she finally meets up with Paul again toward the end of her journeys, and Paul officially confirms that what she's already done in the rest of the story is actually legitimate. So at this point, toward about the fourth line from the bottom, Paul says, go and teach the word of God. Well, yeah, you know, she just spent 6 or 8 pages doing that. So, but it's good that he confirms it at the end. And there are a couple other folks mentioned there. Tryphena is not the same Tryphena that I mentioned before. This is her mother, actually. But okay. This is Paul and Thecla in Ephesus. And actually, this is a plate taken from Dominic Crossan and Jonathan Reed's relatively recent book on Paul. And they've got two plates in there from a cave in Ephesus. And this is the close-up one. And so you see Paul on the left there with his little preaching thing. And Thecla on the right, the same little preaching thing. Okay? Fascinating. The other thing you'll notice is that Paul's eyes are intact and hers are gouged out. And so is her hand. I mean, that didn't get the image by the rain or anything, right? Somebody came along and chiseled that off. It's not uncommon with the Muslim invasion for frescoes and other kinds of cave drawings, would you call it, I guess, mural type things, for them to have been damaged in some way, so the eyes, for example, you know, so that it would not look like an icon, so it would not like look like an image, because this would be, you know, a violation of the Ten Commandments, right? The second commandment about not making images. And so what's weird is, like, they should have done it to both of them if they were going to do that, but they didn't, actually. They only did it to Thecla, which suggests that, and I'm not saying that the Muslims did this. I have no idea who did it. It's just interesting that there it was with Paul and Thecla depicted in basically the same way, except that, you know, she has on the stola that shows that she's a wealthy Roman matron. And he doesn't actually have aristocratic clothing. But anyway, so the kind of defacement of women's tradition, you know, goes back a ways. This is my spin at the end that I mentioned. If Phoebe's Paul's patron, you know, if, say, you know, John Rockefeller was going to found a church in Cleveland and, you know, put up the money and that sort of thing, my guess is they would have let him pick the architect. My guess is further that they probably would have let him choose the plans, the blueprints, you know, which design he liked the best. That Rockefeller, was Rockefeller Catholic? I don't think he was, right? So him not, yeah, he must have been a Calvinist. That him not being Catholic, they probably would have let him pick the pastor that he wanted there. I mean, that if this was going to be Rockefeller's church, it was going to be his church, right? That no one was going to argue about it because, well, it's his money after all, right? We still have a lot of churches actually in this area, not Catholic churches necessarily, but that's the way it works, right? The rich people are on the vestry, the church, the parish council or whatever, and they determine who comes to pastor, they determine what the policies of the parish will be, they determine whether they like what the preacher is saying, and if not, you know, when it's time to say goodbye, and, you know. I'm not saying Phoebe pushed Paul around. Okay. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that if Phoebe pushed Paul around, he wouldn't have noticed. He wouldn't have noticed. He was not an aristocrat. He was of the trades class, you know, calls himself a tent maker. He's a leather worker, right? He's earning his living by making objects with his hands. Heavy labor, right? Stinky labor, too, actually, but we don't have to go there. She's not. She's an aristocratic woman. She earns money by making other people work hard. Right? She's got money to spare. She's giving him some of it. She's helping him decide how to spend it. A Roman looking at that relationship would say, oh, okay, so this Paul guy, he's a client of Phoebe. He's a co-worker. Phoebe. And we look back and we say, Phoebe was a co-worker of Paul. Who's right? Thank you very much.
Have to give credit. This is the researcher.
There you go. Sheila, thank you so much for your words. It's been interesting over the years as I have heard these names, and now I can kind of put a little more of information and faces with them. And I remember some 35 years ago, I was in a class on the epistles taught by Lynn Elsick.
Oh, yeah.
And she definitely had a thing, you know, looking at the women, and she was very challenged because it was all men in the class. But we learned a great deal, and we appreciated what we have discovered. So we're going to have a brief intermission. A couple of things are going to happen. At this time, we're going to pass around a couple of baskets, and we ask for a free will offering to help. If future church and the many programs and activities and things that we are about to try to reach out to all people and to share and bring our mission together. At this time, I'd like to ask Sister Chris Schenck to come forward and just share some of the things that are going on, and then we'll have a time of question and answer with Shayla.
Thank you. It's wonderful to see so many of you here. There's a lot going on. It's very exciting. One of the things I do want to remind you of is that on October 8th this year, we're very privileged to have Father Thomas Reese, a Jesuit, former editor of America, currently at Woodstock Center at Georgetown. He will be speaking to us. This is our annual benefit, and his presentation will be on reforming the Vatican, what the church can learn from other institutions. It's based on a terrific article he wrote in Commonweal last fall. So tickets will be available online, as well as additional event information in your Mary of Magdala folder tonight, so if you want to take a look at your program. We do need some help with our committee. Our dinner benefit committee. It's a great group. They're a lot of fun. So if you have some hours to give and to spare, we could really use your help. Anne-Marie, there she is, our wonderful benefit coordinator, development director from Future Church. If you would see her, we would be most grateful. Well, the other thing is, as long as I'm working at Anne-Marie, if you haven't yet become a member or made a donation to Future Church, please do so. There's a tear-off on your program. We're very much grateful for your support. We can't be who we are or do what we do without your help. Also, just on your table, a little orientation, there are Mary of Magdala brochures, a recent article that was published in America or in National Catholic Reporter about the mission of Future Church, the best article that has ever been done on Future Church, the holism of our mission. So please feel free to pick that up. I'm also very gratified that America, in its July 4th issue, published a book called, an article that I wrote called It's Not All About Eve. And it also reprises the work at our Synod on the Word. It's available online. Or if you're already signed up on our Future Church Update email list, we will be sending out the link for that probably sometime next week. So we were gratified that our Jesuit brothers are really standing by their commitment to women of the church. And that brings me to, I always say, we'll really love to do these programs, but what really matters is what each of you do when you leave here tonight in the way of concretely looking at what you can do to advance this understanding of women's leaders in the early church and the need for expanding ordination beginning with optional celibacy. So you have two cards in your program. The first one is our brand new optional celibacy, so all can be at the table. We're calling on the officials in Rome to open the conversation about, at the highest levels of the church, about the need to return to our earliest traditions of permitting both a married and celibate clergy. We have reason to think that we're reaching a tipping point. Cardinal Hummus is head of the Congregation of the Clergy, and it is on his desk that all the appeals from parish closings, which number probably around 50 by now around the United States, land on his desk first. He's also on record before he left Brazil saying that celibacy is a discipline of the church and it could change. And also, he was very powerful about the bad effects of the priest shortage in Brazil at the Synod on the Eucharist. So if you fill this out, If you can save a dollar, we will happily collect them and send them corporately in envelopes. If you want to send it yourself, that's perfectly fine. We really like postcards because we know that they made a huge difference at the Synod on the Word last October, where three of the four requests we made at the Synod were successful. We had the most women ever, included women biblical scholars. There was a proposition that talked about women and the ministry of the Word. And in response to our concern raised first by Sister Ruth Fox in her article, Women in the Bible and Lectionary, Phoebe, the wonderful leader of the church at Cancrae and benefactor, funder of Paul's mission, is deleted from the middle of the lectionary text, the Romans 16 reading during the week, and the lectionary just slices Phoebe's name right out of there. Just as it slices out the name of the mission, commissioning of Mary of Magdala to go and tell my brothers, her apostle to the apostles commissioning, the reading on Easter Sunday stops just short of that mission, and we never hear of that commissioning in any of the Sundays during Easter.